The following is a Radiovisions presentation.
Europe, November 16, 1944. Allied airstrikes support offensives of the U.S. 9th and 1st Armies. 1,200 U.S. 8th Air Force planes and 1,100 RAF bombers drop 10,000 tons of bombs with the goal of obliterating German fortifications. The U.S. 9th Army advances toward the Ruhr River. The U.S. 1st Army attacks toward Durin. In liberated Belgium, disagreements between the Belgian government and representatives of the resistance movement results in the resignation of three ministers. On this day, 21-year-old U.S. Army Air Force Staff Sergeant Albert Richard McCooch meets his rendezvous with destiny. This is his story in his own words, recorded 54 years later, shortly before he passed away.
Interrupting this program for a moment to bring you a news flash.
This is Bruce Belfrage. Here's some excellent news which has come during the past hour.
Frank Gillard has just come through with a message to the BBC to say that American First Army troops crossed the Rhine yesterday at a point south of Cologne and have established a bridgehead on the far side. And that's the end of this news flash from the BBC in London.
And good morning. We'll go over the front lines at 23,000 and drop to 21,000 for the IP. Flares at the IP will be red, red. Flares at the bomb
when
drop
I got home,
will be yellow.
I spent probably 2 or 3 years reliving the experience every night.
North, and I
would wake up just saturated, just soaking wet from perspiration. It was a very hard time. I've never discussed it for many, many years. It's still very painful.
The time will be 04:15 on the mark. 3, 2, 1, mark. Thank you, gentlemen. Good luck to you all. Adjourn.
November 16th, 1944, target was Metz, France. The purpose was to bomb troops. We had no difficulty getting over the English Channel, and we started our bomb run. We were right on target over the forts. We opened our bomb bay doors and released our bombs. All the bombs dropped out, except there was about 15 still stuck in the bomb bay. So we had our bomb bay doors opened and continued on, with the intent of when we got out of the enemy territory, we would salvo the bombs and get the rest of them out. As we left the target area, we encountered some anti-aircraft fire. And back at that time, the Germans just came out with a rocket. And this rocket had tremendous force. It was a real bomb, and it had a very high altitude. It would go far above the airplanes. We weren't very fortunate this day. This was our 24th mission. that you were shipped home on your 25th. Well, unfortunately, the 24th was our unlucky number. This rocket came up and struck our number three engine in the right wing. That would be the inboard engine. The wing immediately caught fire. I was flying at the time in the tail of the plane. Usually the smallest person flew in that position because it was very difficult to get into. Apparently when that front engine dropped out, I'm not sure what happened, whether it pulled out the gas lines or what may have happened, but we started losing more engines. We lost the two engines on the left wing. The only engine we had going for us now was the outer engine on the right wing. The plane would fly, but you couldn't gain any altitude, and all it did is sort of mush through the air. The pilot was trying to keep the nose up, but it was just dragging. I started forward in the plane with the intent to make my way into the co-pilot's compartment to see what else we might be able to do to keep this plane in the air. As I started down through the fuselage, I noticed that many of the crew had bailed out, and they were going by the rear window of the plane, and their clothing was on fire. And the ones that jumped were the ball turret operator, the radio operator, the waist gunner. I guess that was about it that jumped out of that back doorway. I made my way forward into the pilot's compartment. I was told by the pilot, co-pilot, that the bombardier and the navigator that flew in the front of the ship bailed out of the front hatch. And the other engineer that flew the top gun also bailed out of the front hatch. And I had no idea what the pilot, co-pilot's game plan was. So I went back into the fuselage and tried to salvo the ball turret. And I thought I'd drop all the weight I could, and it would buy us some time. I toggled out some of the remaining bombs that were stuck in the bomb bay also. But I couldn't find the tools to release the ball turret. So we continued on, and we continued to lose altitude. It was very, very misty. The windows in the plane were wet. We just couldn't see through them. The windows seemed to clear up somewhat. I was back into the waist. We were still at about 500 feet. All hell broke loose, and bullets came ricocheting through the fuselage. And I went to the side of the airplane at the gunnery stand on the left-hand side. Looking down, I saw a row of German soldiers. They were right along a hedgerow. There was sort of a pasture, and then there was a wooded area. And they were all lined up in this wooded area. But to understand why these soldiers were still firing on us, knowing full well that we were in a crash mode, that we were going to come down. We still had some remaining bombs, and we still had some fuel. We were pretty much doomed. But I was so infuriated with the firing from these soldiers, knowing full well that we didn't stand a chance to survive this. I became so infuriated that I got under the waist gun, which was a 50 caliber machine gun, and I opened fire. I fired right into the troops along the hedgerow, and I regret to say that it looked to me like I've got a large number of them. A 50 caliber slug is a very, very big slug. Now we were just sort of mushing along, and I went back into the cockpit one more time. We had a little conversation between pilot, co-pilot, and myself, and we realized that we were in some real serious trouble. We couldn't continue to fly at this altitude. We knew that we were in big trouble. So we had a small discussion. We said a little prayer. We decided that we're going to let the plane right down. We shook hands, wished each other well, and wished them luck. And the pilot at that point said, okay, he said, I'm just going to nose it in. So I pushed the controls forward. We didn't go very far. I was standing directly behind the co-pilot. The top turret was between the co-pilot and the back fuselage. It was directly behind the co-pilot, and I was standing behind the co-pilot with my hands on his seat, the back of his seat. Well, you could come through a clearing occasionally and see some things. I looked out, and all I saw was a huge tree right alongside of our plane. The next thing I know, there was a lot of racket, and it ripped the right wing right off the plane. And the right wing fell to the ground, probably several hundred feet down below. In the meantime, I had lost consciousness, of course. As I started to come around, I could hear fire and I could hear ammunition exploding, and I couldn't quite determine what was going on. But as I laid there, I realized that I was saturated with gasoline. The wings sort of fell into sort of a hollow, and we still had hundreds of gallons of gas in that wing. I laid there in this hollow in the gasoline. But I could hear ammunition going off, and I could hear fire. And I couldn't understand why I wasn't on fire. I couldn't see anything. I had gas in my eyes and face. I found out later I had a fractured femur and damage to my right arm. I heard someone walking through the brush. I couldn't see them. I recognized him as the pilot. It was unbelievable for me to think that he actually got out of that wreck. But he did get out and came back close to me. I asked him how the co-pilot was, and he said the co-pilot had been killed and that he had no idea where we were. He told me that he didn't know if we were still in enemy territory or if we cleared it and we were in our lines. He said, "I just don't dare touch you because you're in bad shape. You're rolled right up into a ball." And he didn't know what to do for me. He said, I'll try to make my way out of here and see if I can't find some help and send them back to you. So again, the pilot and myself wish each other luck, and he left. He wasn't gone long before I heard some rustling in the woods, and then I began to hear voices. I still couldn't see. The voices started using the word Bosch, 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 and I understood Bosch to be German. So I hollered out, and they says, "No, no, I'm not Bosch. I'm an American." At this point, I had no idea who they were. I didn't know if they were German troops or what they were. But it turned out to be Belgian civilians. So it wasn't long. They hailed down some sort of a vehicle. It looked like an ammunition truck that they used to carry ammunition up to the front lines. They got me in this vehicle. There was two fellows in the vehicle with me and the driver. As I laid there, I was in such misery with this gas and this fractured femur. Back in World War I, you didn't survive a fractured femur. You died from the shock. And they were going to take me to a field hospital, which is something like you've probably seen MASH. It was a tent up near the front lines. As we started for this unit, one of the people in the back of the truck with us pulled out a cigarette, and he got out his lighter, and I could vaguely see this. He was holding his lighter, and I knew he was going to strike it. And if he struck that lighter, I'd have went up like a torch, and so would the vehicle. So I had managed to I couldn't speak. I had voice at times, and I just stared at the other fellow in the truck. And he caught my eye, and he looked, and he saw what was going on, and he wrenched the lighter out of the man's hand. We continued on. They ended up in a MASH unit. And, of course, I was unconscious most of the time. I come to in this unit, and there was a group there administering last rites. Your dog tag gave your religion, so they administered last rites. I assumed if they administer last rites, you're probably going to pack it in. But I seem to have survived it. I came around. My next move was they hauled me into a hospital in Liège, Belgium. When they got me there, they stopped short of the hospital, and we were some distance from the hospital, as a matter of fact, and it was getting dark. They were unloading us, and they had some people there to carry the litters. These people took a hold of my litter, one in the front and one in the back, and they started down towards the hospital. And as we moved along, the fellow in the front of the litter sort of stumbled in a pothole or something. And when he did, I let out a scream because the bone hadn't been set and I wasn't in a cast or anything. And that bone just ground together and it was just so painful. So I let out a scream and they continued to carry me. And when they realized that I had some broken bones, they started playing games with me. They would take and just flip the litter in the air and sort of drop it, sort of flipping you like a pancake. So I thought, my God, I've got to stop screaming and do something here. So when they decided to flip it again, I noticed that the man in the back, when he got ready to flip it, he would sort of bend over to get some momentum to come up with it. Well, as he bent over, I managed to get an arm lock right around his neck, right around the back of his neck. And I just pulled him right down to the litter. And of course, he had to come down to the ground. And the guards heard all the commotion. And I told them that apparently these prisoners were taking a lot of advantage of these poor crippled GIs. I told the guard what they were doing. And he said, well, we'll take care of that. And he called in some more troops, some more GIs that he had in the area. And they told the boys that were carrying the litter to move over away from the litter. But the last that I saw was these fellas with their rifle butts pounding the devil right out of these Germans. I have no idea what happened to them, but I don't think it was anything good. We got into this hospital in Liège. We weren't there too long. We were advised that the Germans were zeroing in on a hospital with heavy cannon fire. And they were getting closer and closer with their shots, so they decided they had to evacuate the hospital. So they started removing us from this hospital, and they were going to take us over to England, which was going to be quite a trip. And most of it was by railroad. And they had very small railroad cars there. And they were just twisted and turned very easily. They were a very uncomfortable ride. And of course, again, with this rickety ride, it was absolute torture with that fractured femur that still, of course, hadn't started to knit. We got into a hospital in England. There they prepared, of course, to put you in a full body cast. They then got me somewhat patched up and got me into a bed in this large room. And of course, you know, the discussion is who are you, what are you, where have you been? Well, I made the sad mistake not knowing. I told them I was with the 8th Air Force. And we were in flying fortresses, bombing over in Germany. Everybody's ears in that ward perked right up. They started screaming at me, and the ones that were mobile could walk around, came over to my bed. They were ready to do me in right on the spot. And I couldn't quite understand this, but in the course of the conversation, as people came in to quiet them down, these were people that were in the Battle of the Bulge. And unfortunately, the flying fortresses bombed these troops. They were in the infantry. A signal was to come up as to when to release the bombs. This was in the forest, and that seemed to be the only way they could get the troops out of there by bombing with personnel bombs. but not realizing the Germans did break the code and got the signal as to what the signal was going to be and when. And of course the signal was when the flare was shot, as we would cross the flare, we would release our bombs. The Germans got the code and they moved back. They sent some people back and they fired the flare behind our own troops, or just at our own troops, and we released our bombs. And we got many, many, many of our infantry with the bombs. We got to the point where at the hospital there, they had to put me in a separate room to keep them from tearing me apart. I was on that bomb run. I was on that airplane. But unfortunately, that's a part of war. Now it was time for them to put us on a ship and send us home. I'm not sure, I can't recall, whether we were on the Queen Mary or the Queen Elizabeth. We were on one of those ships. We were in the hold, in the bottom of the ship. People that were in casts and couldn't walk, weren't mobile. They seemed to be in the hold of the ship, and then people graduated up depending on their capability of getting around. And on our way over to the States, we understood they were chased by a submarine. And of course, these queens, the Queen Elizabeth and Queen Mary, I understand, could outrun a submarine. So they took evasive action and changed their course, and they made it back to the States in fine shape. Our concern was, is why did all these fellas have blue tags and green tags, and we had red tags? Well, we found out from some of the people there that if you had red tags, and that ship was in danger of sinking, they would come along and give you a shot to put you to sleep. And I believe probably the shot would be a permanent sleep. We got back in 3 or 4 days, and all was well. And then from that point, why, I was still in bad shape. I was still in this cast in a hospital in Girard, Pennsylvania. From there, they sent some people through. They were looking for somebody to talk to employee absentees. They were mostly young girls. They would work, get a few dollars, get whatever money they thought they needed, and they wouldn't show up for work. And this particular plant was manufacturing butterfly bombs. And of course, this was really hurting the war effort because they weren't able to get their work out. So they selected two of us and they took us into town in Girard and put us up in a nice hotel. Our job was they would cart us around to the various homes of these girls who were absent and just had a chat with them, telling them of the importance of their jobs. By not working, they were kind of jeopardizing the troops out there in Europe. So we gave them a pretty good pep talk that sort of turned things around with a lot of them. And they went back to work. Made the front page in the newspaper in Girard, War Heroes Touring Defense Plans. That made us feel kind of proud to think that we were contributing in some way to the war effort.
This is London calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead. I repeat that. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
And now Mr. Churchill stands on the balcony of the Ministry of Health. He's wearing his boiler suit, the famous boiler suit that he's made so wonderful. And he had the audacity, shall I say, to put on his head his famous black hat. Nobody can say that it goes with a boiler suit, but you heard what a cheer it raised from the crowd. Now listen, the band is playing Land of Hope and Glory, and the crowd is singing. And this suddenly has become a very moving moment, for Mr. Churchill too is singing, and he is conducting the singing of this song. Will you listen, please?
Thank you.
This presentation is dedicated to the B-17 crew flying with Albert Makuch that day. Pilot, First Lieutenant Donald George Springstead. Co-pilot, First Lieutenant Robert C. Barnes. Navigator, Second Lieutenant Edward Gregory Jacobs. Bombardier, Second Lieutenant Francis Samuel Tierney. Radio operator, Tech Sergeant Frank Joseph Schick. Engineer and top turret, Sergeant William C. Murphy. Ball turret, Staff Sergeant Paul Leland Watson. Waist gunner, Staff Sergeant Hilton Hubert Stevenson. And of course, engineer and tail gunner, Staff Sergeant Albert Richard Makuch.
Thank you for listening.
This has been a Radio Visions presentation. Special thanks to the Makuch family who provided us with Albert's story, the 8th Air Force Historical Society, William LeCay of Reimst, Belgium, researcher Mike Stowe, and 8th Air Force veteran Adolf Schwastik. The Albert Makuch story was produced and directed by Charles Langdon. Engineering by Ed Myers. This is Lee Shepard speaking.